Blog Talk Radio. That are as different and compelling as their three authors. I'm literary New England radio show host Cindy Wolf Boynton, and tonight my guests include multiple New York Times best-selling author Lauren Oliver, whose edgy new YA novel Vanishing Girls has earned her even more tremendous reviews. It's her 10th book, yet she says she still gets nervous to send a new creation out into the world.
Failure and anxiety are reasonably twin features of an author's life. They're continuous.
I also talk with Bostonite Nina McLaughlin about Hammerhead, a warm and inspiring memoir about Nina's decision to quit her newspaper job to become a carpenter's assistant. It's only just been released.
Seeing people come up with the book, it's more satisfying and more exciting than I sort of
Starting off the show is my conversation with Sylvia True on her debut novel, The Wednesday Group. It tells a story of five women who share never-before-told secrets when they meet at a support group for partners of sex addicts.
But it's not about sex. It's really about betrayal, shock, and shame, and learning how to overcome that.
I'll be giving out copies of each of these books, starting with Sylvia True's The Wednesday Group. As you'll hear in our conversation, she's a chemistry teacher who decided to follow another passion and write a novel. That novel took several forms before it evolved into what became The Wednesday Group, which goes on sale tomorrow, March 24th.
The story in The Wednesday Group is about five women who don't know each other who decide to join a support group for wives or women who are married to sex addicts and just an assortment of different kinds of sex addicts. But it's not about sex. It's really about betrayal, shock, and shame, and learning how to overcome that. And each woman has to sort of find her own path and decide what she wants to do with the new, not always newfound knowledge, but what she wants to do in her own life and in her marriage, and what boundaries she needs to make and what she can handle.
So the book focuses on five women. Can you tell us briefly about each of them?
Sure. So one of them is a part-time photographer. She has two children, and she has known about her husband since actually before, the day before she got married. She discovered he was a sex addict, and she went to his therapist with him and learned a little bit about sex addiction and that it was, quote-unquote, a disease, and I have some issues about what to call it, whether it's actually an addiction. I don't want to be unfair to people in terms of how to label it or what it should be called, but she went with her husband to the therapist and decided that it was some sort of a disease, and it wasn't that he was necessarily cheating and that she would work with him over the years. But what happened to her really was that as the years progressed and as they had children, she sort of, you know, denied it. Not completely denied it, but turned away from it. Didn't, you know, wanted to believe it was over, wanted to believe it was something of the past, which it wasn't, as she finds out in the beginning of the book. Another one of the characters, whose name is Bridget, is the youngest one. She's a psychiatric nurse, and she discovers that her husband has been on all sorts of sort of chat rooms and, you know, sort of looking for that high in, you know, the hookup websites, that type of thing. And she doesn't believe at this point, at the beginning of the book, that he's actually had an affair with a woman or slept with anybody. Another one of the women is Gail. She's a pretty prominent judge in Boston, and her husband's a professor, and she knows he's been unfaithful, and he also goes to therapy, and she believes as well that he's working on his addiction. And I'm trying to think, what is that, four? Then there's...
That was three.
Okay, my counting skills, not great this morning. I am a chemistry teacher. Well, that will bring me right to Lizzie. I am a chemistry teacher, and Lizzie, who's a chemistry teacher, is married to a man who's basically addicted to porn. And she really, I think in some ways, has the most hope that, you know, this is something they'll get through in their marriage. But it isn't. They don't get through it. And the fifth woman, Flavia, is from Brazil, and her husband was caught groping on the T, on, you know, the subway.
Sure.
And she found out about it, actually, through, which is sort of shocking and, you know, difficult, from a newspaper article that somebody showed her. And she decides, in the end, to leave the country with him and go to sort of a small island in Greece, where she thinks, well, there are no subways, and obviously that will make it better. Of course, it's another form of denial and running away that never really quite works. But. So those are the women.
So this is your first novel, and I think it is incredibly ambitious to have so many prominent characters in your first novel. What made you jump in so big?
It's a funny path that gets us there. I wouldn't say I certainly did not think, like, I'm going to jump in big and start with all these characters at all. It's kind of a crooked, twisted path. I started with, you know, I write for, you know, I'm not supposed to say it, but a hobby. It's entertainment. It's an escape for me. And I was writing a completely different kind of book about a murder on a cruise ship, believe it or not. And one of the characters is running away from her marriage. And that was the only one that sort of held me. I took her, brought her back to this country. And then I wrote sort of almost a completely different book about a therapist, the therapist who is in the book, and her struggles with getting a doctorate degree and keeping a viable group. And as I was writing her story, the women sort of took over. And that's really how it happened. Didn't start out thinking, okay, this is what I'm going to write. I wish I was that more, you know, sort of concrete, sequential thinker. I'm not at all. So, you know, I sort of follow the feelings and the messages that come. And it was clear that the women were the ones who wanted to tell their story.
So this book basically morphed out of another book. And where did the sex addiction part come into it?
So because of my life and what's happened to me in my life, and we can talk a little bit more about that later if you want, but because of that, I am very drawn to exploring issues of shame. And I think that right now, sex addiction is something where there's still a lot of shame around it. It's sort of whispered about. And that is what really drew me to that issue. And I read about it. Of course, I know a few people, not going to go into any details about that, but it's out there more than people realize. And what's really interesting to me is the amount of shame that the women feel who have done nothing. That's the reality. And that really drew me to that topic. And it was something that hasn't been explored a lot in fiction. So that was another reason. You know, I hadn't read a lot about it. I've read plenty about it now, on websites, blogs, books, whatever, but not a lot of fiction. So, again, it just sort of always hinges on this shame that I want to, like, look at.
So So how long did it actually take you to write this book?
Well, it didn't actually take me very long. It's hard to put a time because I work full time and, you know, I have children now, I have a granddaughter and a crazy busy life. It took me like maybe 2 years. I would say 2 years if I had to.
Does that include the morphing process or is that once you finally, okay, so it was actually less than that once you figured out what the book was all about?
I think that once I figured out that it was going to be these women and then I wrote each of the women, you know, each story separately before I sort of, you know, melded them all together, that was quick, interestingly enough. You know, once I knew their stories, I knew how to write it.
I think that's really interesting. Once you knew their stories, once you got to know them, they revealed themselves to you.
Right. I often use, which I'm sure a lot of writers do, I often use letters. I have my characters write letters to me, telling me their secrets and how they're feeling. Like, literally have them write letters to me. So that really helps me get to know them.
I love that. I love that. That's like crazy mystical. I love that.
Right. Because they become very real to me, obviously. And I really want to stay true to them. And they read me. You know, I try to let them lead me as much as I can. Sometimes I get stuck, and almost always when I get stuck, it's because I'm not listening to them. Because some voice inside Sylvia's head says, you should be doing this or you should be doing that. And that will get me off track faster than anything else.
So this book releases to the world on Tuesday, March 24th. How does that feel?
Oh, exciting and nerve-wracking. I've never done it before, so it's been a huge learning curve. I mean, I remember my first year teaching, God knows, 20-some years ago, and how crazy that was and how, you know, I never was sure and I didn't know what was going to happen and, you know, did the students like me and all of that. And how that feels so second nature now. And it's sort of like that, like at first, doing a first, you know, having your first child or whatever it is, it's a first and it's nerve-wracking and it's exciting. And I know that this is a topic that some people will want to read about and some people are going to say, yeah, no, it's not really an addiction. And I totally understand that.
Sylvia, our time has gone so quickly, we need to wrap things up, but is there something that you want people to know about you or the Wednesday group?
Well, I guess if there is something I want people to know, again, it goes back to shame, and my parents fled from Germany and brought with them an enormous amount of shame. I ended up in a mental hospital after my first child was born. And that's where I first started learning about, in that case, it was postpartum depression, but also the shame around that. And I look at now where we are, and I think, wow, we've come a long way, because people can talk about depression and Prozac without it being tremendously shameful. People can even talk about alcoholism. So it's, for me, it's about, you know, overcoming shame and supporting each other and talking to each other about what's really going on. And that's what I want people to get out of this book, and how that in the end is really going to help us.
That's wonderful. Sylvia, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you.
Win a copy of the Wednesday group by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Do the same to win a copy of Lauren Oliver's Vanishing Girls, which, similar to her previous novel, Rooms, involves fear and haunting. Though in Rooms, there were actual ghosts. The hauntedness of Vanishing Girls comes from something else altogether.
Most of my books, I think, have some darker elements to them. And, you know, I was actually thinking in the context of Rooms and then Vanishing Girls, and even my next teen book I'm working on, I think I'm very much interested in the way that people kind of become haunted by their relationships and by their choices and by the specter of their past. And in Rooms, I made that actually kind of a literal presence, or at least I explored that with a literal presence. And Vanishing Girls is different in that, you know, it's more, as they're calling it, a psychological thriller, but it's about two sisters who are very different and but yet have always been very close until an accident that really damages their relationship. And both of them are, again, dealing with all the reverberation of that accident through their lives and also the choices that led up to it that culminated in the accident. So yeah.
So, you know, one of the things I was thinking about when I was looking at it was, you know, your characters, Dara and Nick and Parker. Are those people you actually know? Like, where do the names come from?
Oh, no, I don't, actually. It's so funny how that happens. Well, actually, Parker is actually a real person. I gave that. That was a shout-out to my current boyfriend, whose name is Parker, John Parker, but everyone calls him Parker. But and the book is dedicated to him. But in general, no. That it's actually very rare for me to do that. And to be honest, if I didn't really love his name, I would not have used it. Characters kind of introduce themselves to you, honestly. It's very funny, especially the main characters. They kind of come to you with a name already and with a set of characteristics. It feels like walking into a cocktail party and just meeting people and shaking hands. So Nick and Dara just kind of came to me.
So I've been to some different psychics who have, you know, some psychics, they see people from the other side that they're communicating with, or they see images. Other psychics, it's auditory, they hear the voices. I'm not implying that you are psychic in any way, though I guess you might be. I'm wondering, you know, how do these characters come to you? You know, you get their name, but do they come fully formed? Do you see their face? Do you hear their voices?
They do not come fully formed. They come in kind of, it's a little bit hard to describe, actually. You know, I mean, I think, you know, the reason I compared it to, you usually, you know, they come to you with hazy outlines and you hear them. I mean, I hear them. I hear their voice usually start to talk to me. And I don't think I ever fully see them, you know, in the way that I would see a real person. Although that might be a product of the fact that, you know, I'm not an illustrator. I have worked with illustrators in the past in my middle grade books. And of course, they do see characters and they're able to kind of embody them in a way that I would not have been able to. So I hear them. And then as you start writing, I mean, the process of writing kind of helps animate them further. So you're kind of teasing out their voice, you know, throwing kind of a crumb trail of words down and they're following along and getting closer.
So where did the story of Vanishing Girls come from?
Well, you know, I have a sister and I've always been really interested in exploring the idea of how our identities are really formed and influenced by our siblings. I mean, they say that sibling relationships are even more significant to the formation of identity than even parental relationships. And so I actually had tried to write this book for some time. I had tried to originally write this story right after I wrote my first book, Before I Fall, and I couldn't really find the heart of the story. So I abandoned it after several attempts, but the desire to write about sisters never fully left me.
So I love that someone who's the author of what 10 books, 11 books,
yeah, 10.
Says that, you know, they were having a hard time writing something.
Well, you know, that is a common predicament. I mean, I often am unable to write books still that I want to write. I often attempt to make attempts to write books that don't come together. Failure is a very critical part of the writing experience. And continuous failure. And I think that, you know, if you're not failing, you're probably not pushing yourself.
So how long did, or is there a typical time that takes you to write a book? Because you write, you must write more than one book a year.
I do, but it usually does take me about a year to write a book, at least, sometimes a little longer. I'm just typically working on more than one book at once. So I do end up writing about, I mean, I write about 1,500 to 1,800 words a day, which ends up being, you know, 500, 550,000 words a year, which is far more than two novels, but I obviously don't use most of the words that I write.
So I remember when Rooms came out in 2014 and, you know, part of the big hoopla that went along with it was that, you know, oh my God, Lauren Oliver, she's finally written this book for adults, because your books in the past have primarily been young adults, though there was a couple of middle grade books thrown in there as well. So, you know, you've done all these YA books, you did an adult book, you went back to YA. I'm thinking about the labels that we tend to put on authors, and I guess in some way labels are good. But do you define yourself as a certain type of author?
I have been primarily a YA author for sure. You know, I definitely want to do everything. That is important to me. I read very widely. And, you know, I think people go through different points in their lives and different periods of being interested in certain themes or certain questions that are better explored in kind of one type of novel or another. And I think that in general, I am trying as hard as possible to resist total categorization, even within my YA books. I try to do very different kinds of books. The same is true of my middle grade. You know, I'm working on a teen book now, but I'm also working on another adult book. So, you know, I think that labels can, as you said, be helpful to some extent, but they can definitely also limit not just the author, but the reading experience, because people tend to focus too much on codifying exactly what kinds of books they will or won't read.
But it sounds like that kind of label is not limiting you at all.
Well, I try not to let it limit me, right? I mean, you know, I'm sure it's limited me to some extent, but I don't let it limit what I'm choosing to write about.
So after having written so many books, do you get nervous when a book like, well, I guess any book, but Vanishing Girls, I mean, were you nervous with it being released? You know, will it be as well received as the previous ones? Are people going to like it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Anxiety, failure and anxiety are twin, reasonably twin features of an author's life. They're continuous, yeah.
But you clearly have some kind of gift, because every time one of your books comes out, you get just great reviews.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, I've been writing every day since I was about 9, so that's over 21 years of practice. So hopefully over 21 years of daily practice at anything gets you some degree of talent.
So, yeah, and I think that was interesting. I was reading about you before. So you really grew up in a household where creativity and intellectual pursuits were very much encouraged.
Yeah, my parents are professors, so I grew up very literally in a house full of books, and that was hugely influential. My dad's a nonfiction writer, so he's really the one who taught me the discipline, about the discipline of writing and how important it is to make time for it and do it, you know, daily. And my sister is a philosopher now. She's a professor of philosophy. And yeah, I was really blessed to come from a family that really encouraged kind of an intellectual life and the importance of creativity and innovation and making things, really, honestly.
Yeah, I don't think that we tend to make enough things, or at least young people today don't make enough things. I know I look at my own kids and their friends, and while I try very hard to encourage them to, you know, spend a little bit of quiet time when they aren't being entertained by something electronic, I worry about that in the next generation and not really being able to use their imagination because they've never, you know, they've never stretched that muscle.
Yeah, I mean, I totally understand that concern. I mean, I share similar concerns, although every generation fears for the mind of the generation that comes after it. People felt the same thing about the development of TV, of course, that the kids who grew up watching TV would have a very limited capacity for imagination, and that was not true. I mean, the good news is that to some extent, as a child, imagination is hardwired into you. You know, I do feel that it's very important to the imaginative capacities to know how to be bored and to fill in as a result kind of games of your own. However, it's quite possible that like all of these electronic games and things like that are going to affect the imagination in new and exciting ways that we can't imagine.
That's a, you know, touche, Lauren Oliver. That's a very good point.
Anytime.
So back to Vanishing Girls, is there some type of reader, do you think, who will particularly enjoy the book? And on the flip side of that, do you think that someone who might be hesitant to pick up a book like yours might find something in there that would delight and surprise them?
Yeah, I think that I have answers to both of those questions. I mean, I do think that no matter what, anybody with a close sibling relationship of any kind is really going to find it very resonant, particularly somebody with a sister. However, I also think that, you know, people who are fans of kind of the spate of psychological thrillers, like, you know, I mean, I'm not comparing myself to Gillian Flynn, but, you know, like Gone Girl or Girl on the Train, that kind of thing that inverts expectations and is structured to do that, I think they might be surprised to find that they enjoy Vanishing Girls as well.
I loved Girl on the Train.
I
couldn't put that
together. I loved it too.
You mentioned again for a second time about the fact that you have a sibling. Will your sister see herself in this book?
I don't know, honestly. You know, it's not about, I think she would see echoes and dimensions of our relationship, but I don't think she would see herself necessarily now. I mean, that's kind of the interesting thing about writing novels is that you end up transmuting your experience into something different. And you use your feelings, but it starts to wear a very different face within the context of a novel.
So your friends and neighbors don't necessarily have to be, worried about showing up in
it. No.
And before we sign off, can you give us a hint of what you're working on next, or is it top secret?
No, absolutely. I have a middle grade series coming out this fall that I'm very excited about, called Curiosity House. And then right now I'm working on a book called, a YA book called Broken Things. My adult novel is top secret, but only because it's such a disaster. I have no idea when or if I'm going to finish it.
Well, I'm sure that it's going to be wonderful whenever it gets done. And thanks so much for talking with
us,
Lauren.
Thank you. This was great.
Lauren mentioned that her father, Harold Schechter, is also a writer. He's a true crime writer who specializes in serial killers. But he's also the author of a series of detective novels based on the works of one of New England's favorite literary sons, Edgar Allan Poe. Nina McLaughlin is on quite a ride right now, receiving all kinds of praise and attention for Hammerhead, a memoir really for anyone who's ever wished they could change their life. Nina lives in Massachusetts, and I talked with her last week, and I was curious what she might be wearing. Specifically, was she standing there talking to me with a carpenter's tool belt around her waist?
No, not at the moment. You know, the book just came out on Monday, so for the next week, 2 weeks, it's mostly going to be book-related stuff for me, and then the tool belt will be back on a little later this spring.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I guess it's kind of hard to
sit down and sign autographs and things like that when you have the hammers and nails and whatnot digging into your side.
Yeah, exactly.
So I just think what you did is really incredible. I love it, but when people just decide, you know what, plan A is not working out for me, I'm just going to do something totally different, and who cares what anybody thinks about it?
Yeah, you know, I'd worked in a newspaper for, you know, it was close to 8 years, and it really was a fantastic job, and I loved it. I loved the people that I worked with, and it didn't feel like work to go in and be surrounded by these funny, bright, curious people every day. But you know, after a while, the shine wore off. Started to feel a little bored. Started to feel like a little antsy. And had this kind of vague crave to do something that had to do less with computer screens and more with sort of something tangible. So you know, when I left my job, I didn't have anything lined up. It really was sort of this, you know, all right, like let's roll the dice here and see what happens. And fortunately, it really worked out. You know, there was, you know, about 6 months after I quit, there was this magical posting on Craigslist. Carpenter's assistant saw it when he strongly encouraged me to apply. So I tossed my hat in the ring and ended up getting the job.
So what made you apply? Like, what attracted you to that job versus all the other things you could do?
Sure. You know, as I said, there was this kind of craving to be doing something that has to do with, you know, actual reality as opposed to, I mean, the internet, which is a part of our reality, but for me, I felt like I was sort of wasting my life sitting in front of a computer, and I had no experience at all with carpentry, but when I saw this post, it really was like, oh my gosh, this is it, this is perfect. You know, it was like blinking lights and flashing, my heart started beating faster, and it was sort of, it felt to me in my imagination at that point, like this is the answer to that crave. Like, this is exactly what I would like to start doing. To learn stuff that I knew nothing about, to be working not at a desk. And to be, you know, I mean, I think, I, you know, not at the time did I know it, but, you know, to be working for another woman.
For another woman, too.
I think it was a crucial element. So that's how it sort of, I don't know, lit up in my brain at the time.
And so how did you know, like, was there a moment when you were working as a carpenter's assistant when all of a sudden you were just like, you know what, holy crow, like, I want to be a carpenter?
You know, the way that the interview worked, she spent the people that she interviewed, she had come work with her one at a time for, you know, a half a day or a whole day to sort of see how the fit was. And so that very first day that I worked for her, we were tiling a bathroom, and I had, you know, never tiled anything, never used a tile saw. All of it was very new. And even in that very first day, I thought, oh, my gosh, I love this. This is great. This is so satisfying, seeing the floor at the end of the day, that we, you know, we got the tiles, laid them down. Like, wow, this is great. You know, and I think after getting the job, it took some months, you know, because the learning curve was steep. I didn't know anything, and a lot at the beginning was just kind of lugging heavy stuff and cleaning up and doing really basic stuff. And there were certainly times where I missed the newsroom and the sort of hum and buzz of being part of that. And there were, you know, times where, you know, getting splinters or bashing my thumb with a hammer and just thinking, like, what am I doing here, you know? But I think, you know, I think probably once I felt like I had some competency, could sort of do some stuff on my own. I mean, this was probably a year into it when I was like, all right, this actually does unbelievably feel right. And it's been 6 years now. Coming up this spring will be 6 years. So it does feel for real.
Oh my goodness, that's a long time. So the book, and tell us, where does Hammerhead come into the picture?
Yep, sure. So basically, you know, when I first started, the only way I knew how to learn both from, you know, high school and college, and then in my sort of journalism job, was taking notes. And so I found myself on the job when I was sort of first learning what to do, I was taking a lot of notes, sort of saying, like, all right, so this is how you use this saw, and, you know, these are how, you know, this is what a butt joint is and stuff. But I had these notebooks, and I was finding that I was also, besides sort of including the stuff that I was learning, I was also noting down, you know, little notes about the houses we were working on and the people we were working for and the, you know, things that Mary was saying, my boss Mary was saying. So I had started taking notes from, I mean, really day one, essentially. So I had this accumulation. And I eventually started writing a blog, which is just sort of just the way I thought of it, was just sort of this published notebook about the stuff that I was learning. The weird, you know, the weird kind of distance we were in sometimes in these, you know, strangers' homes. And the way the book came about, I had written a book review for Book Slut, which is a website.
Yes. Same ever,
editor,
yes.
The author of the book that I had written about got in touch saying this was a smart review, thank you so much. The book was Fire Season by Phil Connors, which is an excellent book, and he actually has a new book out this season called All the Wrong Places, which is also extremely good. And so Phil's editor got in touch with me, and I wrote back with my thanks, and I had a little link to my blog at the end of my email, as I do with all my emails. And he wrote back saying something about, you know, his father building bookshelves, and he said, you know, if you're ever considering writing a book, please let me know. So this was truly the best email that I had ever gotten. So I wrote him back, and I said, I am interested in writing a book, yes, definitely. And the conversation started from there. So that's how the book ended up happening. And that was about 3 years into being a carpenter.
That's crazy exciting. And now, were you thinking of writing a book at that time, or did that email spark the idea?
You know, I've always written, and I've always, you know, writing is sort of the thing that I do and has done, you know, all my life and loved the most. So, yes, I've always sort of wanted to write. I thought in my life that I would write fiction, that I would write short stories and novels. So the carpentry book was never, you know, that was never something I would have considered as what a book that I would do would be. Just as a, you know, carpentry as a job, I had never sort of thought that that would be the case for me. It was a surprise that this was sort of my, that this was the book that I was going to be writing.
That's really neat. And now, how does it feel to you to have it out there in the world?
It's cool. It's been done for almost a year, so it's strange to have been anticipating this moment for so long. And it took a while to work on. It took some years to write. So it's exciting. It's surreal. It's great. My first reading was Monday night at the Harvard Bookstore here in Cambridge, and it's wild. And again, it does. There's this surreality to it that you know, I've been working on it for so long, and now here it is in the world.
That's really terrific. And now, as far as your blog, which is Carpentrex, carpentrix.tumblr.com, is that something that you're still actively adding to as far as your experiences, or is it, well, I guess your experiences now are really book focused, right?
Yep. So it's still, you know, up until about last week, we're still sort of writing about, you know, the kitchen jobs we're doing, this end table that I'm building, and all the sort of carpentry stuff. Right now it is a little bit more kind of book promotional focused. You know, as soon as we sort of get back to swinging hammers,
we'll go back to that.
And, you know, the blog has always sort of had a mixture of books in it as well. I've always been writing about books, so I'll post links to the reviews I'm doing and stuff like that. So it's always kind of a mix.
And I'm looking at your schedule right now. You are all over the place. So today is Monday, March 23rd. So tomorrow on the 24th, you're going to be at Newtonville Books in Newtonville Center, Massachusetts. Then you're going to Brooklyn. You're hanging out in Massachusetts. Then you're going to Georgia and North Carolina and back to Massachusetts and up to New Hampshire. Holy crap, you're all over the place.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's neat having all these sort of events coming together. And you know, I'm just on the start of it now, so it's good. Sort of some good momentum going into it.
And how do you feel when people are like, I hate that question, how do you feel? So I'm sorry for asking it. But, you know, when people walk up to you with your book in their hand, I mean, I know when you kind of have a similar experience when you're a reporter and people respond to your stories, but like, this is a book. How do you, what's your reaction when you see it being gleefully held in people's hands?
You know, at this, the reading the other night, a lot of, you know, it's my hometown, so there were a lot of familiar faces and people I love and people, you know, who I expected to be there. The sort of the really neat part was when, you know, there were a few strangers in the crowd. There were a few people I didn't know and were coming up to me afterwards and sort of saying like, oh, this is this woman who was telling me how she built her own small house not long ago, got renovated an apartment. Another woman said that she, you know, had been sort of trying to learn the trade herself. So that was extremely cool to sort of talk to people who were in some way sort of interested in the book or had read part of it and, you know, were feeling excited and inspired by it. I think the thing about it, too, is that it doesn't have to be, you know, you don't have to be into carpentry or wanting to be a carpenter to, I think, find some appeal to it. You know, I think it's In a big picture way, it's kind of about, you know, sort of leaving the life you know for something else. And I think we've all been in situations, either jobs or living in cities or in relationships, where it sort of reaches an end point and sort of you have to make this decision about, all right, what is my life going to look like now? But seeing people come up with a book, you know, it's really, I mean, it's more satisfying and more exciting than I sort of
see.
And now, is there something that you hope that this book is going to achieve, be an inspiration or a learning tool of some kind, or is, you know, what do you see as one of its purposes, perhaps?
You know, it's funny because people do, they have been using the word inspiring, and it is, that's a strange thing for me just to think like, you know, this was, you know, I had one job and then I had another job and then I wrote about it. And so this is my sort of just my boring life. And so it's funny to think that it's, you know, that it's inspiring. It's great to think that it's inspiring to people. I think, you know, if it's something that helps someone kind of summon up the courage to leave what's familiar and comfortable to try something new, that's great. That would be, I mean, that's, I don't know, that seems almost too good to be true. You know, and I think that I hope that it can sort of make people understand that it's very possible. And I think, I hope, you know, a little bit too, that it's can help people know and feel more comfortable with the idea that, you know, women can go into the trades. I think that's another thing, you know, that it doesn't have to be this kind of all male world. So yeah, both of those I would say are, you know, outcomes that would be amazing, you know, too good to be true.
I love that. Nina, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much. Absolutely my pleasure.
I want to give you a copy of Hammerhead. Win it by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. If you follow us on Tumblr, you saw today that from 8 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, April 30th, Literary New England will be hosting a tweet chat with Erica Roebuck and Sarah McCoy, as well as giving away copies of their new historical novels, Erica's The House of Hawthorne and Sarah's The Mapmaker's Children. Both of those books just ooze New England, so I hope you'll mark the date on your calendar, even though it's pretty far ahead, and plan to be there and join us. The Literary New England Radio Show will be back again next week, and I hope you will be too. Thanks to all my guests tonight. Thank you to Lauren Oliver, Nina McLaughlin, Sylvia True, and thanks, of course, to all of you. Until next Monday night when we're back together again, I wish you a great week and great reading.